The time is 2:02 p.m. We are back on the record for the formal hearing continuation of OPAPA 690007 and 011.
Ms. Tang, how many minutes would you like to preserve for your rebuttal?
Maybe 10.
Very well.
10 good.
Are you ready?
Yep. Let me just make sure I'm amazing there.
You may proceed when ready with your closing statements.
Great. Good afternoon. We have been here for a month. We've had hearings 11 days. I understand this is the longest hearing the Office of Public Accountability has ever held. We appreciate the time that the public auditor and Mr. Camacho has given us. This is an important case. It is the single largest procurement that DPW has ever solicited. It's an RFP for the design build, the financing and construction, of the Simon Sanchez High School and the remaining 35 schools. Why are we here? What's at stake? What's at stake and what is important? The takeaways from this hearing is that we have to find a way to provide the best value to the people of Guam for Simon Sanchez and the 35 remaining schools. The issue of preventing the government from writing a blank check, the $100 million cap issue. And we need to ensure that there's fairness, integrity, and most of all, transparency in the procurement process. This procurement has been plagued with problems before the RFP was even issued. What should have happened? In the words of the public auditor, all hands on deck. Everyone at DPW should have been involved. That did not happen. DPW should have had a clear understanding of its duties as a procuring agency. Felix Beneventi, the chief procurement officer, should have had a clear understanding of his duties. And DPW should have complied with Guam procurement law. We know that this did not happen. What went wrong? The government failed to comply with the Guam procurement law, failed to ensure a complete procurement record was kept. The evidence also shows that the government failed to ensure a level playing field for all proposers. The government failed to protect the integrity of the procurement process. And the evidence supports this. Many things went wrong. GFF submitted a non-responsive bid. It left out over $17 million in expenses and costs that were required in the RFP. They dispute that, but the documents, the RFP, and the ensuing communications between the negotiating committee, Randy Romero, Ray Junio, confirms that this was brought to their attention twice in memos that were completely disregarded. The negotiating committee proceeded to change the design parameters, which allowed GIF to submit four additional proposals with new design parameters. Other proposers, such as Cortec and Pernix, were not given the same opportunities. That is an unfair playing field, and it's a violation of the procurement law. There was a lot of evidence taken regarding the state of the procurement record. It's a mess. It's a wreck. It's incomplete and cannot be recreated. They inserted and negotiated an IDIQ contract, which had an overriding mechanism allowing DPW to sign off, the director to sign off, which would allow GIF to just go over the $100 million limit. That's not consistent and compliant with the RFP. Confronted with that, GE's witnesses insist and refuse to acknowledge that they were party to a contract that violated the RFP. Now, let's look at what Guam Procurement Code requires for a complete procurement record. 5 GCA 5249 states that each procurement officer shall maintain a complete record of each procurement. And this is a mandatory requirement. The record shall include the following. It's not optional. There's no discretion here. There are three components to 5249. A says you need to record the time, date, time, subject matter of the names of participants at any meeting, including government employees, that is in any way related to a particular procurement. Very broad, in any way related to a particular procurement. The second requirement, the second category of documents, which we spoke at length about and discussed at length, is the log of communications. The log of communications between government employees and any member of the public, potential bidder, vendors, or manufacturers, again, in any way related to this procurement. Very broad. C, the sound recordings of all pre-bid conferences, negotiations arising from requests for proposals, and discussions with vendors regarding small purchase procurement. These categories of records are mandatory and must be included in order for there to be a complete procurement record. What happens if you don't have a complete procurement record? 5250, 5GCA 5250 mandates that no award can be made if a procurement record cannot be certified. And in this case, there was a huge amount of evidence about the state of the procurement record, and we'll get into this, but Mr. Kalanaya testified at length about his record keeping. And he did say that the record could not be certified, and that means this procurement, this contract cannot be awarded under 5250. I'm going to focus in on the three categories that we covered. Now, we have the date, time, subject matter, and names of participants in meeting. That's category A. And now this is any meetings between government employees. This includes DOE, GITA, DPW, any agency, government employee in any way related to this procurement. Very broad. This includes pre-solicitation, post-solicitation, the evaluation phase, negotiation phase, and award. GIEF's notes and minutes are simply not enough. And while the government has stated that they've supplemented their record at least six times, the original procurement record had about 3,000 copies. We ultimately received about 5,000 documents in total. But we still do not have a complete picture of the meetings that occurred during all of these phases of this procurement. The log of communications, a very important document. It is a log of communications between the employees and the public and the potential bidder. This includes the entire range of communications, emails, texts, faxes, any kind of way, any method of communications, it would be covered under this log. There is one sheet, one exhibit that we were given that it is called the communication book. It covers, it is an incomplete, and entries only on 16 days. Covers 16 days for procurement solicitation that took place over a period of a year. Even the 16 days isn't complete. And it started 6 months after the RFP was issued. It ended 2 months before the award, the negotiation period. There's barely any information on that. And there are no phone call records. And most importantly, If you do not maintain the log of communications contemporaneously, it just simply cannot be recreated post hoc. This is copy of Exhibit 24, which is the log of communications. And Exhibit 24 does not include any communications before the RFP was issued. GEDA's communications with their chairman, E.J. Calvo, is nowhere in this log of communications. Glenn Leongro testified that he talked to the media. That's not in the log of communications. There are no record of any pre-RFP communications, no record of any, or the protest won that was filed in January 2016. Again, if you don't maintain these records contemporaneously, they are lost and they cannot be recreated. The government argues that they've substantially complied in good faith with the requirement of keeping a communication log. This is not the standard or the law. Now let's look at what Mr. Kalanayan said. He has 15 years of experience. He is the head procurement guy, engineer background for DPW. He testified on September 23rd. What did he tell us? He told us that he understood the communications included hard copies of documents, meetings, telephone calls, texts, and emails. This was the range of communications, the spectrum of communications that he was cross-examined on. And he also confirmed that it would have been possible to recreate the entire range of communications. More importantly, he said, look, February 2016, I spoke to the AG, Ms. Mooney, in connection with this foster care RFP, and she told me that I needed to keep a log. So we knew before February 2016, he didn't know that he had a duty or responsibility to keep a log as the record keeper. I asked him, because you were unable to recreate a complete log, DPW would not be able to certify that there is a complete procurement record. His response was, I believe so. Those were his exact words. Now, in spite of the fact that he testified to this on September 23rd, the following week he came back on his redirect. He was a government witness. And he recanted. He recanted. He changed his testimony. DPW's attorney, through leading questions, testified what DPW would like the facts to be. They want him, and he testified on that day, the week later, and said, you know, I thought you were asking about general procurements in general and RFPs. I didn't realize you were asking me about this solicitation or the GEEF. And when I reminded him that the questions that were posed were specifically regarding GEEF and Simon Sanchez, he acknowledged, right, that's correct, those were the questions. DPW is trying to rewrite the law. Substantial compliance and good faith is simply not the law or the standard. If you accept DPW's interpretation, then the law becomes meaningless. We do not concede there has been substantial completion. We do not agree with their interpretation of the record-keeping duties of the agency. A communication log must be maintained, and it must contain all of the communications relating to in any way relating to this RFP. Let's go to sound recordings. Sound recordings were provided, video recordings. We received video recordings for pre-solicitation. But we still haven't, we have not received transcripts of the evaluation hearings. I understand that they're being transcribed, but we're at on the 11th day closing. We still haven't received them. The law is clear. All pre-bid conferences must be recorded. Well, there are no logs. How do we know how many meetings there were? How many videotapes should we get? Are these videotapes complete? Who was there? All negotiations arising from request proposals also need to be recorded. We are aware of at least 18 meetings from Exhibit W that was submitted by GIEF yesterday or the day before. And the 18 meetings, there's no recordings of any of those meetings. Now, we heard of two. Ray Junio recorded a portion of a May meeting. Negotiations began in March. So in May, somebody, a light went off, and I guess he turned on his cell phone, a personal cell phone, which we were informed was damaged and destroyed, water damaged. And so we don't have these recordings anymore. They were able to videotape, and they had the equipment to videotape pre-bid conferences. Why did DPW not record the negotiation meetings? We don't know. Let's look at 5GCA 5249C, Public Law 18-44. Now, there's been quite a lot of briefing on this and dispute over this. They don't dispute, neither the government nor GIEF disputes that there are no audio tapes. What they dispute is that the requirement under this section of 5249 that negotiations have to be recorded. And keep in mind, negotiations, other than evaluation, is one of the most important phases in this or any procurement. And what more accurate record could you have than a recording? Someone's minutes is someone's impressions. It depends on that person's memory, ability to take notes, handwriting, ability to, you know, understand what's going on in the proceeding. Now, $100 million contract, you would think that they would want a complete record. DPW's compiler's version has a semicolon after the word conferences and before negotiations. Because of that, that's a typographical mistake. Because of that, DPW and GIEF have taken a position that there are two phrases. The first phrase is sound recordings of all pre-bid conferences are required. They don't disagree with that. But they say that because there's a semicolon under the compiler's version, negotiations arising from requests for proposals and discussions do not need to be recorded. Well, that just doesn't make sense. Because then what, this is a whole section about maintaining records, then what record of negotiations would you be keeping if not sound? Are you supposed to just take the entirety of the negotiation record and just say, here, this is it? It doesn't make sense. It's nonsensical. It is not the correct interpretation. Furthermore, Public Law 18-44, which was the original statute, legislature put a comma there. It was a typographical error and called it many things, the phantom comma that we put in there. This is not a phantom comma. This is what the law is. This is what the law requires. There's a reason why they put it there. It's the negotiation portion. It's a very important time. Prices and terms are discussed. A record of that meeting is required. Also, when people are being recorded, we know behaviors change. And we also hope that there's less hanky-panky. But when you have no record other than an attendance sheet, you just don't know what happened, what transpired, who spoke to whom, and what issues were raised, and how issues were resolved, and how you end up with a $100 million an IDIQ contract that allows GIEF to override the $100 million cap. Cortex price was disclosed in negotiations. If you look at CT00621, this is an email. I know it's not as clear. From Ray Junio, and the two other names below are Mr. Kalanayan and Mr. Beneventi. that one of the several questions were posed in that email, and Mr. Junio, Ray Junio for DPW, answers them. This is during negotiations. Keep in mind, this is March 14th. The question poses, number five, would you like to reduce costs down to $63 million as the second offeror has given? This is Cortex price. The response is, to me, Mr. Junio writes, we could not just reduce the price until such time we know what the cost included in the $73 million. That's $73 million is the price of Geef's proposal.
Which exhibit is this again?
This is part of the, this is the CT-621. Yesterday I asked if I needed to get one, this was part of the procurement record, and you said as long as it is, I don't need it to mark it as an exhibit, but I brought extra copies if you like. This was produced by DPW.
Okay.
Thank you. Second part of this, continuing
can
on.
Can we just go back one?
Yeah.
Like the that specific page. Yes, I would like a copy of that.
I have extras, and we'll pass them around.
Provide that to the other parties.
Right. Everyone testified that Cortex price was not disclosed. This is not true. If we had tapes, we would know that they discussed this was bandied around. That is why, this is the reason why they went to Geef and said, can you match a $60,000 budget? Now, other questions that were posed in the same email. Now, Geef submitted an original cost estimate and cost breakdown in the amount of $73 million. What was Mr. Junio's response? Negotiations should start from the original cost, which is $73 million as per the RFP requirement. Well, then there's another question. Another added cost was received to a new amount of $89 million. This is plus the $16 million missing cost, of course. Do we reject the $89 million? We need legal advice, since the only amount known in the offer from Geef is $73 million. Response, the added cost estimate should not be considered for negotiation, since the RFP requires that a cost estimate shall be submitted together with the RFP requirements and not during negotiation. How many times did we ask this question during the last 10 days? Why was Geef's proposal non-responsive? Why did they not stop negotiations right then and there on March 14th? What did legal say? Did legal say anything? We don't know. We don't have records. We don't have recordings. We don't have logs. We know that they knew they used Cortex price, and we know that they knew that it was non-responsive. They were told in this email by Ray Junio, Mr. Beneventi, the chief procurement officer, that it was non-responsive. Number three, Geef cost schedules provided are not clear and do not show the cost for each item the RFP requires. So I'm not going to belabor this point. We talked about the $16.1 million missing cost. That's what they're talking about. This was squarely before the chief procurement officer, DPW's advisor, Mr. Junio, responded appropriately, and nothing was done with this. The negotiating committee proceeded to negotiate it with a non-responsive proposer. On September 15, 2016, the public auditor said to Felix Beneventi, we don't give that many $100 million contracts. You are the chief procurement officer. I understand you rely on your staff, but it is your responsibility. I'm mildly disappointed in the manner in which you were not able to answer more precisely what happened in this $100 million procurement. This is a shadow on the people of Guam regarding the transparency of what happens during this process. I hope DPW starts keeping records more properly. What a mess. And this statement pretty much sums it up. Bad procurement, no transparency. Let's go to the $100 million question. The first time we became aware of it is when we saw the Calvin Fisher Jacob firm letter dated March 31st, 2016. And in this letter, Mr. Easter was the recipient, and the lawyers tell him, we understand that based on Jeeves' calculations, the sources and amount of funding identified in public laws 32-120 and 32-121 make more than $100 million available for all schools. We estimate upwards to $160 million. They were really trying to push hard, pushing hard to get this to get past the cap. We know that because a little less than 2 weeks later, on April 13, Ms. Wompat, out of the blue, sends John Fernandez this letter. And she says, these laws, while identifying a debt service amount, do not have a cap in its borrowing capacity. Great. But you know what? When John testified, Mr. Fernandez said, hey, I saw her months ago, maybe early January or February. This letter came to me out of the blue. It was not solicited. Where did Jeeve get this letter? Ms. Damian says in her email, she got it from John. John said, I never gave it to Jeeve. Jeeve is now suggesting that it somehow came from a FOIA. Who is telling the truth? Well, if we had a communication log, we would have some idea of how this letter came about, who, when, what, and where, but we don't. April 22nd, 2016 email about 9 days later, an email from Ms. Damian to Mr. Keeler. She says, sorry, I can't read that. Well, Gita explained to us today in a meeting, however, that although it agrees with public laws, the public laws do not set a cap. The government included the $100 million cap language in the RFP as a self-imposed limitation on spending by the government. Per TINA, this was a fiscal policy decision by the government. The response below is, Jeeve is now aware of this self-imposed $100 million cap, and we are prepared to move forward with the design and the financing for Simon Sanchez High School in the CCIP, and should any funds be left over, additional task orders for the other 35 schools. You would think that this clarified the issue. This was the Mona Silva testified that Champ Calvo was in a meeting, Ms. Damian was in a meeting. She said in no uncertain terms, this is the cap. This is a fiscal decision, policy decision. Even though the law may allow you to exceed over $100 million, we are setting the cap in the RFP controls. And it was intentional. This was not an accident. 4 days later, what we see is a draft version of the IDIQ. In this particular version, there were earlier versions in the procurement record. This is the first version that we saw that contained the overriding mechanism, which included the words, pursuant to otherwise directed by government in writing and permitted by public laws, 32-120 and 32-121, or any other law. So Mona Silva, if you recall, she testified that when she was shown this language, this draft, she was shocked, visibly shocked. She said, did this provision comply with the RFP? She said, no, this is not what they discussed 4 days ago with Guy's lawyer. This was the near final version of the contract that they signed. The only change, at least for this provision, the final version, instead of saying the government, unless directed by the government, it says, the final version says, unless directed by the director of DPW. and permitted by public law, DPW in writing and permitted by public law. Let's look at the version that they did sign. Exhibit 40. This is the version that was produced in the middle of the hearing while we were in DSID rooms. And we found out that three persons signed. Mr. Flores signed for GIF, Mr. Beneventi signed for DPW, the government, the agency, and Mr. Fernandez signed for DOE. The Attorney General did not sign, and the governor had not signed. But this is the final version, which contains the overriding mechanism, unless otherwise directed by director of DPW, in writing and permitted by public laws. Now, we don't have communications between Mr. Keeler, Ms. King, all the GIF lawyers, all the meetings that happened regarding this. In fact, during this morning's cross-examination of Mr. Easter, we're asking, oh, which lawyers were involved drafting this, you recall? Nobody. Mr. Easter says, I don't recall. I don't really know. I don't know how this provision came in. Did GIF do it? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I wasn't involved. DPW suggests that we just delete this portion and everything will be fine. It resolves the problem. It does not. It does not because the evidence has shown that the parties involved in drafting the IDIQ contract and negotiating allowed the insertion of an overriding provision mechanism, knowing that GIDA did not agree to it, GIDA did not approve it, knowing the RFP limit has a $100 million cap. They completely disregarded the clear mandate of GIDA and the RFP and the deputy administrator's decision and instructions to proceed with a $100 million cap. This was not an accident. And it raises serious concerns as to who put it in there. Simply striking it out does not fix the problem. Let's talk about the performance bond. The performance bond is discussed in our brief. And the reason we have raised this issue is because in the negotiation memorandum, the one that was attached to the intent to award, they said, well, you know, Hansel Phelps, GDP, is going to provide, the subcontractors will provide bond. Well, that's really strange because we know what the RFP requires. The RFP mandates that the performance and payment bond under Section 4215 must be provided by the offeror's contractor. The offeror is GIF. The offeror is not GEDP. No one on the evaluation, the evaluators didn't know who GEDP was. And that party was going to provide the bond. That party that was going to be the sub-developer was going to provide a bond. That's not what this section requires. Sorry. TUGAR Division 45104 says the performance bond must be delivered when the contract is signed. Everybody's saying, well, we're talking about a construction contract between Hansel Phelps and GEDP. No. They're talking about the IDIQ contract. In the body of the IDIQ contract, it talks about the $76 million contract to Simon Sanchez. It must be delivered at the time the IDIQ contract is signed. And when asked, if you call, Mr. Emmons says, well, you know, I think Hansel Phelps is going to just do the Simon Sanchez portion, but, you know, we're not sure who's really going to do the CCIP and remaining portion. Is it full? Is it some Calvel entity? Is it GDP? We don't know. Their bond and their background has not been scrutinized and reviewed by the evaluation team or the negotiation team. They weren't evaluated. GEDP was not evaluated, but GEDP is doing everything. They're the one contract. There's sub-development agreement. They're contracting with Hansel Phelps. They're going to figure out who's going to do the remaining 25 and post a bond, 25 million remaining amount. But they can't tell you who it is today because they haven't decided. That's not what the RFP requires. $100 million, every penny has to be accounted for. Hansel Phelps or whoever it is better stand up and be part of the team to be evaluated. not some team that's going to be determined at a later date. The subcontract to GDP is illegal. The RFP does not permit it. We still don't know today who GDP is. Mr. Inman says, well, okay, it's, you know, Cham Calvo, Jamie Wilson, and myself, and Bill Beery, and Jay Lather. Then who's Jeef? Well, Phil Flores, Leonard Calvo, and myself, and Wilson. And the name changes depending on which hearing you ask. They were not the, GDP was not the offeror. And they are doing all of the work on this contract. Government of Guam approved the developer's wholesale subcontract of the development agreement with GDP, and that was in the IDIQ contract. And the government, and if you recall, Mr. Inman testified that, well, the government's going to prepare it. And when pressed, he says, well, the government's a party. I said, really? The government's a party in between a private contract between GEEF and GEDP? And then when, during the break, I came back, and he says, well, we did that in Okudu. So I happened to get a hold of Okudu's contract, development contract, and on cross-examination, I showed it to him. I said, where's the government in this? This is a private contract. He finally conceded. The government, his statement, the government will be drafting the development agreement between GEDP and GEFS was false. The improper modification of the RFP and GEEF's four new proposals. We know that Randy Romero was very, very involved in this process. He provided two analyses. His first was in Exhibit 36 and 37. Exhibit 36 was the email that had the 37 attachment. We covered this morning during Mr. Easter's cross-examination. And he states on top of his analysis, the purpose of this document is the evaluation of GEEF's RFP submitted cost proposal against subsequent letters dated February 24th, February 29th, March 3rd, 2016 that provided additional costs associated with the construction of Simon Sanchez High School that was not disclosed in their RFP submission. And he goes on, if you recall this morning, we talked about the quote from the RFP proposal, I'm sorry, the proposal of GEEF, and how that was missing cost. You also recall Mr. Easter completely forgot what they put in their RFP, their proposal, never mind that on direct, he happily talked about it. Mr. Romero, in his March 14th email, I believe, March 11th email, with an attachment, sends this to the entire negotiation team. It was sent to John Fernandez. Mr. Fernandez, if you look at Exhibit 36, copied everybody on the negotiating team. They were aware of this issue, including DPW's counsel. What happened? Nothing. They continue with the negotiations. No communications, no response. This is just one part of his analysis. Let's go to his April 19th internal memorandum. If the March 11th memo analysis didn't wake anybody up, you'd think April 19, 2016 internal memo would. It did not. And here, he raises this issue again. Look, there's $16.1 million that's missing from GEEF's original proposal. And he says, this is excluded. This was excluded. This is an RFP requirement. These are project costs that were not included. And what he said was, he goes on to say, that GEEF's original proposal excluded these fees, architectural and engineering, collateral equipment, 1% arts fee, the profit, contingency, and overhead. And he said, look, GEEF submitted a non-responsive proposal when it excluded the $16.1 million cost. This was in the body of the memorandum. If it wasn't clear on March 11th, it should have been very clear on April 19th. Is this fair that GEEF gets to submit, not just one, but four, and then has an non-responsive bid, gets to add it? It's not fair. It's not equitable. It's cheating. Randy Romero doesn't think it's fair. He states in his April 19th memo, a quote, The reduction of square footage equates to lesser classroom, reduced sizes of buildings, and removal of buildings. This results in changes to parameters stated within the RFP and is a disadvantage to the offers who proposed offers based on the parameters of the RFP. He is right, and we agree. Let's look at public law 58D and E. Requires the delivery of best value. We've talked much about this, but what we did not achieve best value. Best value, according to Mr. Romero's memo, April 19th memo, circulated, was that best value is not achieved by compromising school requirements. If you look where we are, where we started at $89 million, ADF was $78 million, but a much smaller school. The RFP, Exhibit A, requirements were compromised in order to do that. And he states so in his memo. He also says, well, why don't the focus of the negotiation should be reducing the profit or negotiating G's profit or overhead or other costs or numeric costs. But that was never done. It was always pushing, reducing the design parameters and the need, the building, the structure, to get to a number. And that's what he complained about. Statutory limitations in negotiations, very clear. You can only, during negotiations, talk about 3114L, talk to the offeror, make sure he has a clear understanding of the scope of work, B, determine that the offeror has available personnel and facilities, and C, agree upon compensation, which is fair and equitable. This is crystal clear. This was completely disregarded. Addendum 7 says, collateral equipment, attachment A, is a reference to be considered a minimum requirement for the Simon Sanchez High School. Why did Mr. Romero, you asked a question, the question I asked myself is, why did he prepare the March 11th and the April 19th memorandum? He tells us. He told us during his direct, his examination. I was hoping that this memo would open some eyes. Did it? No. Do we have any responses or correspondence? No. Did negotiations pause to investigate these serious concerns? No. It proceeded to award. Who really cares about the students of Simon Sanchez? We all do. But you know what? By his acts and his writing, Randy Romero cares. And he still does today. When he came back on redirect, he didn't recant. He stood by his memo. He stood by his testimony. He did not buckle under pressure. John Fernandez testified about the memos. You know what he said? Says, I don't have any disagreement with the memo. He says, no, I don't take a different, but he has a different agenda. He's desperate. He was desperate to build the schools for the children, for the kids of Simon Sanchez. We get that. And he was willing to compromise to achieve that goal. It has been suggested that the public auditor should forgive all the mistakes, the lack of procurement record, clear violations of procurement law, and attempts to saddle the taxpayers with an unlimited debt. If the Office of Public Accountability deems that this procurement record is adequate, with all of its violations, all of the missing information, then no procurement on Guam will ever be bad. And this procurement record law is rendered meaningless. And how can our community have faith and trust in our government if our highest offices are excused from scrutiny? They should set the example of transparency and accountability. Thank you.
Okay, you have, I know you reserved 10, but from my count, you actually have about 16 minutes for your rebuttal at this time. Should you choose to, is that correct? Just rely on your map.
No, I have forgotten. About 6.
I was looking at that clock, but adding 20 minutes.
Yeah. I have 16 minutes.
Huh?
I have 16 minutes.
Okay, so you'll have 16 minutes if you choose to use them. Mr. Keeler, the closing arguments?
Yes. Senator Juan Pat is a liar. Ms. Tang made that statement a number of times in these proceedings. It was based on a number of items as she described it, a process server's affidavit, and a telephone conversation with Ms. Tang or her office with an associate of the senators. Again, I emphasize an associate of the senators. There apparently was never any direct communication with the senator. Rule 45 of the Rules of Civil Procedure provide that personal service means personal service. It is strictly interpreted and does not mean handing a document or a subpoena to an assist.
Mr. Keeler, I normally don't interrupt during closings, but we've already rendered an opinion on this issue.
I'm just making one or two more comments.
Okay, but it was denied on the grounds of cumulativeness, not whether or not service was effectuated. So that issue
understood.
Is not really an issue.
Well, we have the Speaker of the Guam Legislature having been called a liar in a proceeding. I think it's appropriate to make a few comments regarding it.
I would say that if you could stick to the contents of your letter in your closing, which was the main thing at issue in this appeal, you may proceed.
Okay. In the same token, Cortec's primary allegation on appeal, at least at the beginning of these proceedings, that being that the government colluded with the chief to negotiate a contract in excess of $100 million, is based on innuendo and speculation. Cortec primarily relies on three documents. Number one is Cortec Exhibit 6, which is chief's counsel's March 31st, 2016 letter to Mr. Easter. Private counsel letter to their own client. The second item is an April 13th letter from Senator Juan Pat to Mr. Fernandez memorializing a January 7th, 2016 telephone conversation. Mr. Fernandez testified that he had contacted the senator in the beginning of the year to find out what funds were available and whether the negotiating committee was required to obtain additional legislation before going out with a new RFP. Not amending the current one, but to go out for a new RFP. The intent was never to combine the two together. And finally, Cortec Exhibit 40, Section 3.1 of the IDIQ contract, which states the added language, unless otherwise directed by the director of DPW in writing and permitted by the various public laws in Guam law. The language is innocuous. The language is superfluous. There isn't a private contract or a public contract that can't be amended if it's authorized by law. So whether you take the language out, which is probably going to end up being the case, or keep it in, it doesn't change the authorization for the contract to be amended if that's what the parties negotiate. Okay, but if you recall the testimony of all negotiating committee members as well as chief's witnesses was that the contract is for 5 years, it's for $100 million cap. Now, if you take a look at section 2.2 of the draft contract, it specifically states, issuance of task orders will require DPWs, GITAs, and DOEs principals, okay, various administrators and directors. The reason for that is clear and obvious. No one party was going to have the ability to increase the amount of the contract. So when you reference 3.1 where it says by the approval of the director of DPW, well, again, it's going to require the approval of three government agencies. That was intended specifically to ensure that there was a control on the expenditure of funds. The negotiating committee is keeping their hands in the procurement, and they are not going to be signing task orders or amendments unless all three parties agree. In Ms. Travis's cross of GITA's Ms. Tyron, she commented that she found the timing of one of the drafts of the IDQ, which was dated, I think, approximately 4 days later after Keefe's meeting with GITA, to be curious. Ms. Tang, in turn, continually used the term, what if, to witnesses. What if the director changes? What if he amends it? It's the government's position that curiosity and speculation as to what if or may occur is not the basis for an OPA appeal. CORTEC, however, doesn't even need curiosity and speculation to file a protest. In Addendum 6, CORTEC Exhibit 2.7, in the request for information phase of the procurement, CORTEC asked whether there would be an amendment to include cost as part of the evaluation. DPW's response, no. Cost will have no evaluation factor. This, in turn, was confirmed in Addendum 7, specifically at CORTEC Exhibit 2, page 50. It was reconfirmed by the government. So, at the time CORTEC filed and submitted its proposal, it's on full notice that price would not be a factor. In DPW Exhibit Q, page 2, that is the DPW's notice to CORTEC that it was the second-ranked proposer, and it was received on December 24th, 2015. Exhibit R, DPW Exhibit R, is a copy of January 7th, 2016 protest by CORTEC. In its protest, it specifically states, despite the requirement to consider value, DPW excluded the cost of construction or and or development fees from the evaluation criteria in its request for a proposal. CORTEC's on notice that price is not a factor. It doesn't matter to them. They still protest. In the protest, they also state and provide the definition of best value. by DPW Exhibit L, January 19th, 2016, letter from DPW to Cortec, they were notified that the protest was denied. Cortec did not appeal. Therefore, there should be no issue that Jeef is the highest ranking and qualified proposer. Although, I note for the record that with its most recent filing, Cortec has raised this issue. As they didn't appeal it, it is not properly before the OPA. In addition to which we'll point out in more detail in our formal filing, it is also untimely. Basis and facts for that particular argument have been known for 3 to 4 months. With regards to, in as it's been raised, I think it's appropriate to address, with regards to Cortec's proposal, I'll address just real briefly. Mr. Easter testified that Jeef's proposal specifically referenced A&E costs, which we know are capped at 6%, arts, which is capped at 1%, and specifically stated that certain items weren't included. The government, therefore, was on full and proper notice as to what the proposal was. Section 3.7 of the RFP, which is noted at Cortec Exhibit 1, page 15, addresses proposals as responsive or non-responsive. Now, throughout these proceedings, Ms. Tang has emphasized this provision as being mandatory. If you review that section, it is clear that the language is permissive and not mandatory. I reference
what,
that.
What exhibit again, Mr. Kerr? I'm sorry.
Cortec Exhibit 1 at 15.
Thank you.
Okay. I reference that because the evaluation committee, as well as the negotiating committee, were fully aware of what was contained and not contained in Jeef's proposal. Pricing was not included as a factor in the evaluation proceedings or phase. And the language is permissive, not mandatory. Jeef had a reasonable explanation for that. And we'll get to that when we talk a little bit more about the Exhibit A, Simon Sanchez High School considerations. But their testimony was that unless you know the quality of the material and the details of the components, it's simply not able to price certain items. Section 3.7 of the RFP, also at Cortec Exhibit 1, page 15, states, if an offeror is found non-responsive, the determination must be in writing, made a part of the procurement file, and mailed to the affected offeror. There is no such document in the procurement file. It is obvious that no such determination has been made. Cortec contends that Jeef submitted 4 different proposals. This is not consistent with the testimony and the documentation. Jeef itself typically uses the term programs. Superintendent Fernandez used the term scenarios. Ms. Tyron used a similar term. I can't recall exactly what she stated. If you take a look at Cortec Exhibit 49, that being a March 16, 2016 letter from the Deputy Director of DPW to Mr. Easter. It states in part, to facilitate the committee's understanding of costs and parties' negotiations, Chief is requested to provide a detailed cost breakdown for constructing Simon Sanchez High School with a budget of $60 million. Again, to facilitate the committee's understanding, these are not construction people. It's an educator, it's the deputy director of DPW, and an administrator with the GITA. These people were looking to try to get an idea as to how the programs were properly being priced. In this particular letter, they request a breakdown regarding design costs, demolition costs, collateral equipment costs, construction of the classrooms, etc. I mean, there are a number of them. These people didn't know, are not experienced with pricing. They wanted to get a better understanding. It was to educate them, not to obtain a new proposal. Similarly, Cortec Exhibit 50, and this would be a Jeep letter to DPW, it is stated, in part, in response to your request, we asked our design team to develop a more efficient program in order to meet the school's needs. And again, yet another example is an April 2016 letter from Mr. Easter to John Callanian, Cortec Exhibit 51, where he states, over the last week, Chief Cheen has worked closely with Guam DOE and DPW to refine the size and program for the new Simon Sanchez High School. This process has entailed several meetings with representatives of both GDOE and DPW. It is appropriate to point out at this time that Mr. McHale, in his last recross, testified, and I don't want to mischaracterize it, I don't know whether he stated it was an assumption or that he would have, he was figuring on that Exhibit A, being Cortec 215, that's the Simon Sanchez High School considerations. Again, he assumed or stated something similar to that the government would have used a planner in the developing of that document. That's important in two very important respects. One, Cortec has testified, and we'll come back to this in a little more detail, but they've testified that the terms considerations has a technical term, technical definition. Well, if it was prepared by teachers and a principal in coordination with the Department of Education, which is the only evidence, and I believe it's undisputed evidence in these proceedings, how can you assert that it has a technical term? Possibly, I'm not positive, but I believe possibly he would have stated that he would have been surprised if a planner wasn't included. Concerning the procurement record, the government acknowledges the concern with DPW's director, deputy director, and CIP's John Callanian, particularly in a procurement of this magnitude. DPW asserts, however, that there is a reasonable explanation. First, the testimony of the director and deputy director was clear that they rely heavily on Mr. Callanine. This isn't in dispute. Thus, in their respective dealings on the public school procurement, they relied on Mr. Callanine as they normally would in any procurement. And this isn't unreasonable. Mr. Callanine was, in fact, the single point of contact for this procurement, assisted with the pre-RFP meetings, and he and Mr. Junio assembled the RFP developed at the pre-RFP committee meetings. Thus, for all practical appearances, both DPW's director and deputy director reasonably thought that Mr. Callanine was working on the public school procurement as if it were any other procurement. That Mr. Callanine's understanding and testimony that his role was more limited in the current procurement is also understandable. The explanation for this is that Public Law 30-120 and 30-121 do not authorize a standard procurement. This is special legislation for one procurement and one procurement only, that being the benefit, reconstruction of Simon Sanchez High School, the repair and maintenance of the remaining schools, and the development of a CCIP. The legislation authorizing the procurement designated two separate committees, both of which were headed by the superintendent of the Department of Education. Thus, Mr. Callanine was not a member of either committee. His reading of the statute was that the government's designated officials were the ones that would be handling the evaluation and negotiation. Further, he didn't receive any written instructions, and apparently no verbal instructions, directing him to do certain items, directing him to do much of anything. So while the communication or miscommunication between the government officials is disturbing and is acknowledged as such, facts concerning the procurement record are: one, in its initial filing, DPW submitted to the OPA over 3,000 pages of documents and correspondence. The Department of Education failed to submit certain pre-RFP documents, the government supplemented the procurement record. Indeed, as noted in Ms. Tang's closing, there have been 6 supplemental filings. One of those was supplementing GITA's documents. The government has been doing that in compliance with its statutory obligation to ensure that the procurement record is complete and that the filings with the OPA are complete. There have been discussions as to whether there is a requirement to record the negotiated meetings. It's the government's position that is not. This has been fully briefed. The only items that are required to be recorded are the evaluation committees, and we're all familiar with the tapes that are being prepared. With regards to the negotiating committee, and I'll deal with this in the procurement record discussion, it is the government's position that the Quartec Exhibit 12, which is the May 13th, 2016 memorandum prepared by the negotiating committee, fully complies with the government's obligations to memorialize the negotiations. To GAR, Division 4, Section 3114, subparagraph M states, at the conclusion of negotiations resulting in the award of a contract, the head of the agency conducting the procurement or a designee of such officer shall prepare a memorandum setting forth the basis of award, including the evaluation factors, and I'm not quoting this exactly, precisely the principal elements of the negotiations, including considerations relating to price and other terms of contract. All memorandums shall be included in the contract file and be available for public inspection.
What was that regulation again?
3114. 2 GAR.
I got that.
3114, subparagraph M.
Thank you.
I believe Mr. Callanayan testified that other than the procurement log, which I note is not listed as a requirement on Quartec Exhibit 4, namely the AG Form Certification of Completed Procurement Record, that he is not aware of any documents that are not made part of the procurement record. Again, there's evidence or testimony that the procurement record currently stands at over 5,000 pages. With regards to the item that's missing, which is the procurement log, Mr. Callanayan stated he made a mistake. He was wrong, he should have. He's also stated and testified that he's been directed by the Deputy Director of DPW to work on completing the procurement log, and that he intends on doing so before the finalized contract is forwarded on to the Attorney General's office for review and signature. And that is DPW standard procedure, that the certification of a completed procurement record is submitted at the time that DPW intends or is prepared to submit the contract to the Attorney General's office. My final comments with regards to the procurement record are, Mr. Callanayan has testified and it's established that he was the single point of contact, that it was his practice upon receipt of the documents, print it, put it in the procurement record. Again, he wasn't doing the log, but there's no evidence that the information from the log or the information he received is not in fact in the procurement record. Quartec, which has the burden of proof of establishing that the record is not complete, has not identified a single document in these proceedings that they know is not in the procurement record. Again, with a lot of things, there's been speculation. Quartec has referenced, well, what about this? What about that? Again, Mr. Callanayan has testified everything he is aware of is in the procurement record, with the lone exception of the log which he's working on and with Mr. Junio's lost or destroyed tape. Therefore, there isn't anything on the record showing that Cortec has been prejudiced in any manner. Concerning the use of the term considerations, I would note that in the original RFP, I would note that in all of my years of practice, I've never been in a proceeding where two words that are used every day and everybody in this room has a complete understanding of. And yet, we're being told that considerations does not mean considerations and requirements does not mean requirements. I'm just dumbfounded. And I again note to the fact, and I emphasize, that Cortec's own witness, Mr. Mateo, has stated that he assumed, or something similar, figured that the RFP Exhibit A was prepared in consultation with a planner. It wasn't, and it's entirely unreasonable, therefore, to assume that a technical definition, assuming that even exists, can be applied to the exhibit. The exhibit was prepared by teachers, lay people, and it's unreasonable to argue that the word consideration should have a special meaning. In support of that, it is clear from Cortec Exhibit 145, which was the original exhibit, and state it is entitled Simon Sanchez High School Requirements, there's a note that's contained in there. And the note is in bold and states, all given figures drawings are for general guidelines and for reference only. That language is pretty straightforward. At Cortec 215, I believe, 16, thank you. Final exhibit is designated Exhibit A. It's entitled Simon Sanchez High School Considerations. Considerations. We all know what that word means. If there was any chance of ambiguity, which I don't believe there is, it was incumbent upon Cortec during the RFI phase of the procurement to request clarification. It failed to do so. The language is plain and simple. Therefore, considerations does not mean requirements. Mr. Fernandez testified that it was like a wish list. That was consistent with other testimony of the negotiating committee. In the same token, we don't need an expert to tell us what plain, simple English states. If you go to Cortec Exhibit 1-7, Section 2, which is entitled Intent, the last paragraph states, once a firm is selected, a scope of work and fee estimate will be negotiated to perform the required services
for each selected school. Requirements is not in there. If requirements was intended, that word could have been used. Again, there's just simply nothing credible to state that we shouldn't use our own daily understanding of what considerations and requirements is. Concerning Jeef's structure, I'll allow Jeef to primarily address this. However, the idea that an entity, that you can't form a corporation and all of your experience of your members goes out the door is just silly. It's a silly argument. If I were to open a law firm tomorrow, I don't say that I have 1 month of experience. Obviously, all of my experience comes with the team members that are part of the group. It's simply, there's just no basis for arguing that if your entity, which Jeef has testified and explained, that it's in order to be bankruptcy remote, so that they're in structuring it that way to protect the interests of Guam and the bondholders, the idea that it can't be an it has to be an existing entity from 10 years ago is just simply not credible. With regards to the contract terms, I remind the OPA that in the opening statement, the government emphasized and pointed out that it is a draft document. It has not, or at that time, had not been reviewed by the AG, had not been submitted to the governor's office. We have not continued working on the contract, which I believe will be amended, because these are proceedings, and we do not wish to proceed with the procurement as it stated. Having said that, I've already commented on Section 3.1 that I consider it to be a completely innocuous and superfluous section. Any contract, public or private, that can be amended, can legally be amended, can be amended. You know, you can have language in there, you can take it out. It just simply doesn't matter. Nonetheless, again, there's protection that was required by the three negotiating committee members to ensure that they were able to protect the interests of the Guam and to control financing. With regards to the subcontract provision, I think the government's position is that Cortex is correct, that that's a draftsmanship item, it was probably a mistake, and I think it's fair to say that the Attorney General will not be signing off on the contract as long as that provision's in the contract. I note, however, these are contract provisions. This isn't a procurement item, this is a contract provision. The remedy, which again we'll address in our brief to be filed next Friday, the remedy isn't to overturn the negotiations, it's simply to tell us, change the provisions. That is the proper remedy if there's a poorly drafted provision. I've already referenced that this government's position and cited the statutory authority for it, that the May 13th, 2016 memorandum complied with its obligations. I'd like to go back to that because I think it's appropriate to note Mr. McKeo's testimony concerning the bottom of page 3. And that would have been concerning, his testimony was that, well, first off, the memorandum states that the RFP consideration states that there's got to be 22 English rooms. I believe Mr. Easter testified that that would provide enough space for upwards to 4,000 students, obviously well in excess of what is needed under RFP, which I believe states that it's for a maximum of or minimum of 2,300. So obviously it is clear the department and the government, Department of Education and the government are not getting the best value if they're required to build 22 English rooms. However, Mr. McKeo stated, even if it provides no value to the school, even if it provides more, is more costly, notwithstanding that, the government is required to build them. When he stated that, that was the last question on my initial cross of him, it appeared clear that it was a painful response. It was not a prompt response. There was a delay, I don't know of exactly how long, half second, second, and he shook his head three or four times, and it was a forced response. Yes. That's at least how I saw it. Mr. McKeo is a paid witness. I don't believe his response with regards to that question is credible. In closing, it's the government's position that Cortex's case in chief relies primarily on innuendo and speculation. It is undisputed that Jeef was the highest ranking proposer. Mr. Ho testified to such. It is also clear that the negotiating team, in rejecting Jeef's request to contact other government parties and staff and different agencies, intended to maintain control of the negotiations and to ensure that they weren't delegated. Those responsibilities were not delegated to staff members. They wanted to keep hands on. Mr. Kalanayan testified the procurement record is complete with the exception of the log, that he's working on the log, and he will not forward it to the deputy director for signature until he can reasonably and accurately represent that the log is completed and that the procurement record is completed. The May 13th, 2016 memorandum documents that the government acted in good faith, provides the details of the negotiations, complies with statutory requirements, and is the best value for the Department of Education, the residents of Guam, and specifically and most importantly, the students and staff of Simon Sanchez High School. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peel. Before we continue with Mr. Agnew's closing, let's just take a brief 5-minute recess because we've been at it now for almost 2 hours.
We're off the record at 3:33 p.m. Time is 3:42 p.m. We're back on the record for the formal hearing continuation of OPAPA 16-007 and 16-011.
Mr. Agnew, you have the floor for your closing argument.
Thank you, Mr. Camacho. Well, we've come full circle in these hearings after a month, and on behalf of BEEP, we're presenting our closing statements, and I just want to go back to the beginning, sort of, and outline really the issues that are at stake and the issues that are before the public auditor, to just focus our attention on where we began, what the proceedings developed into, and where we are now. There are two protests at issue here. I think it came up during the hearing that there were actually three protests that were filed by CoreTech. But the only two protests that are at issue in these appeals are CoreTech's second protest, which was filed on May 27, 2016. That resulted in what I call the first notice of appeal, which was filed on June 23rd. And then also CoreTech's, what we call CoreTech's third notice of appeal, which was filed on July 15, 2016. And that resulted in its second notice of appeal, which was filed August 10th. Those proceedings were consolidated and resulted in the combined hearing that we've been undergoing for the past month. So just to quickly summarize, because I think these issues do have a bearing on the issues that have been attempted, that CoreTech attempted to raise during these proceedings and its filings, and also during the hearing, their filings and during the hearing, are with regard to its first protest of January 7, 2016. And in that first protest, which was not appealed, CoreTech chose not to appeal it, they asserted this ground that cost should have been part of the evaluation factors of the RFP. Now, DPW denied that protest on January 19th, 2016, okay? And I've also included cites to the appropriate exhibits in the record. And its protest here is in DPW Exhibit B, okay? Those were the grounds of CoreTech's protests back then, and CoreTech did not appeal that denial. Now, the reason why I bring this up is because I think the government made a point of this in the beginning, and we agree that CoreTech's attempt to insert this issue of cost, the evaluation of costs, what were excluded from the cost, what wasn't excluded from the cost, were inherent in its first protest. And those were issues that were inherent in that first administrative proceeding, the first administrative protest before DPW. DPW denied that. CoreTech had the ability to appeal it. It didn't. Therefore, it can't sneak those issues into the record at this point. And I'll come back to other issues that CoreTech has tried to insert and insinuate in these proceedings that are just not properly before the OPA. And again, one of the first threshold issues that I would mention is that the issues that are not mentioned in CoreTech's notices of appeal, and we only have two now in front of the OPA at this point, the June 23rd Notice of Appeal and the August 10th Notices of Appeal are improper and outside of the OPA's jurisdiction. Okay. And I'll get to those specifics of these various issues that have been belatedly and improperly inserted through some of its filings and during the hearing as I go through my presentation. So again, just going back and summarizing, what were the issues at stake in the first Notice of Appeal filed June 23rd, 2016? There were really only four, and actually only three, because as I said in my opening statements, the second and third round are really interrelated. They have to do with Exhibit A of the RFP. The first round, CoreTech's appeal was timely filed. And again, I'll get back to the issue of timeliness, because I think that deserves a separate treatment. Okay, the second round. Second ground that CoreTech asserted was that DPW violated this section, and it cited these particular sections of the procurement rules and regulations, 2 GAR section 3114, when it allowed Keith to submit 4 new proposals. That's quoted directly from a Cortex notice of appeal. And what did we hear during the hearing and during these proceedings? Well, basically what Geef and the government said from the very beginning, that these were not proposals, as Cortex misleadingly characterized them. They were elements of negotiations. They were, in this specific context, alternative program designs along with associated price estimates. And these resulted from Geef's negotiations with the government of Guam. And these occurred after Geef's selection as the most qualified offerer. And why do I believe that that's important? It's because it's a fundamental principle of the request for proposals process. The RFP law says that once the most qualified offer is selected, then these elements of negotiations will come into play. And if the government can negotiate a contract and successful terms of that contract with the most qualified offerer, then the award's made. If it doesn't, then you know what it does? It goes to the second ranked offeror. And so in this case, Geef was ranked number 1. The government did come to an agreement with regard to its contract requirements, and so its intent was to execute a contract with Geef. If the government was not satisfied with anything that Geef proposed, it could have simply walked away, and it would have gone on to Cortec as the next qualified offeror. And so we saw from the testimony of various witnesses, most recently Mr. Easter, who really did a great job in terms of going through the negotiations process and explaining exactly what happened. I mean, you know, there's this characterization by Cortec that there were these 4 proposals. And I agree, there's 4 different alternative program designs that occurred along the way. But they weren't developed haphazardly. They weren't developed without the specific work and consultation of Geef in conjunction with the government officials and in conjunction with Geef's designated experts, school design experts. Cortex says that it's unfair to allow Geef to submit these 4 new proposals after DPW evaluated all proposals from all offerors and all ranked offerors. Well, that argument is flawed. You know why? It's because that's exactly what the law provides in an RFP process. It says go negotiate. It says rank the most qualified offeror, 1, 2, 3. And then it says go out and negotiate price with that most qualified offeror. And that's exactly what happened, pure and simple. Nothing more, nothing less. What Cortec is doing, it's confusing these alternative programs and with its associated price estimates with the proposals, the initial proposals, which were submitted by all offerors to evaluate the offeror's qualifications. And that's just not equivalent. They're mixing apples and oranges, and they don't compare. So we heard during the testimony of the various witnesses, and again, as Mr. Easter took us through all the documentation of all the various negotiated alternative programs, okay, and price estimates from Simon Sanchez High School. Okay, this is sort of like a summary, a table, and this came out in the documents. You know, it began here with, in late February, with this facility, which was $89.3 million, with 278,000 square feet, okay? Broken down, however, this was construction costs of $73.2 million. And then what it did is over the course of really, what is it, February, March, and then April, really towards the end of April, what it did is that these numbers through the process of negotiation were refined. And basically what happened is its 4th program, which was evidenced by Mr. Easter's letter of April 22nd, 2016, okay, and this was finally agreed to by the government in its, I believe, April 29th meeting, according to Mr. Easter. And in summary, the figure here was, this was an all-in cost number of $76.8 million with a construction cost of $61.6 million. And this was for a 244,816 square foot facility. Now, the negotiating committee memorandum that was extensively discussed during the course of the hearing documents in general and summarizes the process that the government and Keith undertook to arrive at these figures and to arrive at this final figure. And as we saw in Mr. Easter's testimony over the course of several hours, we actually saw that these negotiations did not occur overnight. They actually took course over a period of weeks, and there are multiple meetings, 18 meetings total. So there was a lot of work that went into this, and I believe it was even Mr. Easter who testified in this gale that the process that went into this, the expertise and the work that Guy brought to the table in actually advising the government of Guam was sort of gratuitous to the government. The government got the benefit of Guy's expertise and professional opinions in refining the scope of Exhibit A, which, as Mr. Keeler pointed out, was really undisputed during these whole proceedings that they were not developed with the assistance of any particular expert. They were developed by the students, the staff and the principal of Simon Sanchez High School. Again, I don't want to go into this in more detail, but I think I point out in the beginning that there's a difference between the request for proposal process and the invitation for bid, and I think CoreTech is seriously confusing the two, because their arguments assume, really, the procedures that are involved in an invitation for bid. In an invitation for bid, an offer is bound by the price that it offers, by the bid it offers. The bid is awarded to the lowest bid that's submitted to the government. There's no considerations as to quality or qualifications. It just says, this is what we want. We have these specifications that are inflexible. Submit your bid. And you know what? The one who submits the lowest bid is going to win. That's what CoreTech thinks this procurement is about. That is not what this procurement is about. If we had done things the way that CoreTech wanted to do it, we would have been in violation of the law. Keith would have protested. The government wouldn't have allowed this to occur. The AG's office, which is by law required to supervise procurements in excess of $500,000, is required to guide this process along the way. They would have never allowed that to happen. So I think that's really a fundamental consideration to be made here, is that there is an intellectual disconnect here in CoreTech, from CoreTech's point of view. This is not an invitation for bid process. It's an RFP process. And again, just to summarize, IFP process, there are no negotiations. The government provides inflexible specifications as to the particular product, invites potential bidders to bid. All bidders submit their bid price by the deadline. Bids are open. The bid is awarded to the lowest responsible bidder. Okay? And that's not what a RFP process entails. An RFP process, as we heard and we see in the law and as the OPA knows, and which was also conferred by Ms. Gale in her testimony, is a qualifications-based selection. Negotiating price and scope of work in an RFP. So what governs? And as I said this before in the beginning, and as was discussed also extensively throughout the course of the hearing, this is what the RFP provided. The famous section 2.0 of the RFP at paragraph 4, CoreTech Exhibit 2, page 7. What does that say? Once a firm is selected, a scope of work and fee estimate will be negotiated to perform the required services for Simon Sanchez High School. You know, a multitude of witnesses testified it was undisputed that this meant, from the government's point of view and from Guy's point of view, that this meant that you select the most qualified proposer, then you negotiate the scope of work. And so CoreTech disputes exactly what the scope of work was to be negotiated, but we have testimony in the record from people such as Mr. Fernandez, such as Ms. Gale, such as Mr. Inman, such as Mr. Easter, that the scope of work involved what were the proposers supposed to do? What kind of a school were they supposed to build with Simon Sanchez High School? What were the requirements? What kind of school? How many classrooms? Were the classrooms sufficient? Were there a sufficient number? Were they sufficient in size? And as I will go on, in my presentation, what we discovered during the course of the hearing is that the specifications, the so-called specifications in Exhibit A, which were itself labeled considerations. When we looked at it actually in more detail, it just confirmed the nature of that title, that those were simply considerations. It said, consider red palm. What are you going to consider with a red palm? What kind of red palm? How many red palm trees? How many red palm trees are they requiring? It said gardenia. I also recall in Exhibit A, it said gardenia, consider gardenia. Well, I think as Ms. Gale said, what do you mean gardenia? What kind of gardenia? Where are you going to plant these gardenias? In fact, some of those plants, depending upon the type of plant that was involved, would cost hundreds of dollars. Some of it would cost, you know, less, a lesser amount. But a lot of these, the point being that a lot of these things were subject to interpretation, and a lot of the general parameters that were set forth in Exhibit A were exactly that, just general parameters that were subject to a wide range of interpretations that could only be narrowed down through the process of negotiation and through the assistance of professional school design consultants and other professionals such as architects and engineers. We also cited this particular section of the procurement law, section 3114. And it's not coming out very clearly here, but I won't go into it in detail, but we believe that this provision also provides the basis for allowing a scope of work to be negotiated. So not only did the language of the RFP allow it, also the procurement law allowed it, that after the selection of the most qualified offeror, you undertake negotiations, which include discussions as to the required services and the scope, complexity, and nature of such services, right here at the end. So did DPW violate 2 GAR 3114 when it allowed GIF to submit 40 proposals? In GIF's view, I believe the evidence showed that the answer was no. Okay, the third ground again, and I've discussed this, I'll go over this briefly because I think it's related to the second ground. But the third ground that CORTEC raises, the negotiating team did not have the authority to modify the RFP or to accept GIF's new proposal. And this centers, like what I said, around Exhibit A. Was Exhibit A flexible or inflexible? I think the public auditor just cut to the chase and asked some of our witnesses, I think it was Ms. Gale at some point. Ms. Gale, do you believe that Exhibit A contained specifications that were flexible or inflexible? I believe Ms. Gale responded, they had to be flexible because you could interpret it otherwise. There's a lot of ambiguity in that document. So again, the key points that I think we got for the hearing, and this is something I brought up in the hearing, and it was revealed during the course, something I brought up in the beginning during my opening, and it was revealed during the course of the hearing, is that Exhibit A is part of the RFP. It's a 12-page general document entitled Simon Sanchez High School Considerations. Exhibit A is flexible. There's some testimony here that it was simply a wish list. I think it was Mr. Fernandez, and I believe it was also in the procurement record in some of the notes. This was just a wish list of what the principal and the faculty members of Simon Sanchez High School desired. And also, as Mr. Keeler pointed out, and I agree that it was undisputed, that list, what was contained in Exhibit A, was developed by the Simon Sanchez High School principal and staff. And this was testified to by multiple people, Romero, Fernandez, and Easter, and also that was contained in GIF Exhibit LL, I believe. No professional assistance in developing that. And again, this is Exhibit A to the RFP. And this summarizes what we believe the weight of the evidence showed, that Exhibit A was flexible, was called considerations for a reason, rather than mandatory requirements, and it was intended to consist of flexible guidelines and general parameters, which would provide a basis from which the government and a successful offer could negotiate the final scope of work for construction of Simon Sanchez High School. And also, if we didn't also have the testimony of Mr. Fernandez, the from DOE. We also, this was also a quote from his declaration that was filed early on in the case. Exhibit A to the RFP was prepared by GDOE. As the title states, it was intended to provide considerations and not requirements for the construction of Simon Sanchez High School. And again, this is a summary of the testimony that was elicited in response to this. We have testimony from Mr. Fernandez, Mr. Romero, who testified that Exhibit A was designed by the Simon Sanchez High School principal and staff. And let me briefly touch on Mr. Romero, who I believe CoreTech relies as sort of its star witness in these proceedings. But I think it's important to place his role in these in this procurement in the proper context. Mr. Keeler questioned Mr. Romero, and it was undisputed that he was a staff member. He was not the superintendent of education, and it was not in his place to make any decisions. He didn't have any say in the selection of the most qualified offerer. He didn't have any say in the negotiation committee. He wasn't part of any of those committees, and he couldn't be because the statutes specifically identified which specific individual would be on both of those committees. And so when Mr. Keeler asked Mr. Romero the question, if the superintendent is okay with these requirements, are you not okay with it too? And he said yes. We also have the testimony of Mr. Inman, Mr. Easter, Ms. Gale, and, I believe we have the declaration, but the hearing officer has already ruled on that. And then we do have, of course, testimony, contrary to that, from Mr. Macchio and Mr. Ho himself, but look at the context of that. We don't find that testimony credible. Mr. Macchio, at the very end, I think he really just killed his testimony in the last question because he said, Exhibit A, do you mean that that wasn't developed with the assistance of a professional consultant? I mean, for 4 weeks we had been talking about Exhibit A as being developed by only the principals and staff, and he said, well, I would assume that it was developed by a professional, but I would have some serious concerns about that. So in my mind, it really undercut the credibility of his testimony when he attempted to interpret what was contained in Exhibit A and whether or not those were requirements, and his testimony was that they were requirements. And if taken to an absurd level, as Mr. Keeler questioned him, he said, well, then taking your reasoning to a logical extreme, even if the committee determined in the end that 22 classrooms was too many, would the government still be required to build 22 classrooms? And he said yes. Even if it was to be excessive, even if it was to cost the government a lot more money, to be wasteful and inefficient, he said, it doesn't matter. You're still beholden to that. That's not the best, that's not certainly not a best value to the government of Guam, and it's certainly not in the best interest of the territory. This is just, again, summarizing what's in the negotiating committee memo, and I agree with Mr. Keeler's comments in the end that negotiating committee memorandum actually satisfies the requirements of 2 GAR section 3114M, where it says there shall be a negotiating committee memorandum in the file, and that's to support the government's negotiations with whatever proposer it was able to negotiate a contract with. And so we believe it's Steve's position also that document satisfies the requirements of the record and what's required in the law. These are just further examples of the classrooms. Again, the downsizing or the right sizing from 22 to 18 and the auditorium. Again, we've had extensive testimony on that, so I don't think that it bears repeating, but again, the emphasis here is that there was a process that was undertaken over many weeks and with the assistance of GIEF's professionals, which allowed the government to actually get a better view of what its needs were. Okay, we go to the bond, the issue of the bond, which I think that despite CoreTech's protest is really just a small, if not a non-issue in this case. First point, as DPW points out in its agency report, no bond is due at this time. Why? I really find it ridiculous that CoreTech is saying at the time that you execute, the IDIQ is when a bond is due. Go to any surety and ask them, give me a bond based on this 12-page document that contains no specifications whatsoever, no drawings, no details about when the school is going to be built, what kind of school is going to be built, how big the school is going to be, and the surety will just close, shut the door in your face because no surety is going to give you a bond at that time. There was extensive testimony in the record from Mr. Easter and Mr. Inman, and with, I believe, other witnesses, that the time that a bond is due is at the time that the task order is executed for the construction of Simon Sanchez High School. And that makes sense, because at that time is when all of the documents, the specific documents, are going to be in place. That's the time when the actual bond is due. Now, as to who is going to obtain the bond, well, the RFP itself, as I said in my opening statements, the RFP permits the prime contractor to obtain the performance and payment bond. And again, this is the section right direct from the RFP that allows that. Giefs' prime contractor is Hensel Phelps. There's been multiple testimony about that. Mr. Inman testified about that. I believe that Mr. Easter testified to that also. That Hensel Phelps, as the prime contractor, will obtain the bond, and also Hensel Phelps is bondable up to this amount. And I don't think there's any dispute that not only is Hensel Phelps bondable, but it will be able to obtain the bond at the required time. And as we've also offered, and to emphasize, that we've made available that letter from Travelers in case the OPA wants to review that in camera. Okay, back to the first round of the appeal. That we believe that Cortex appeal was not timely filed. And I raise this because I believe that timeliness is a jurisdictional issue and it cannot be waived. Despite the protestations of Cortex saying the government conceded timeliness, I think that it's an issue that deserves looking into, and I think because it's jurisdictional, it's a threshold matter. So with regard to Cortex May 27th protest, again, Geith believed it's not timely filed because the grounds for the protest, that is the price and scope of work, that the price and scope of work were negotiated during contract negotiations are founded upon the language of the RFP. And because this is found upon the language of the RFP, its protest is untimely because it knew about such grounds long ago. That is upon the issuance of the RFP and its addenda in 2015. The May 27, 2016 protest was simply filed too late and way beyond the 14-day protest period. Okay, so that summarizes my review of the first notice of appeal. So in the second notice of appeal, there are actually fewer issues involved in this. Three, actually. Again, number one, timeliness. Number two, the IDIQ contract envisions Giefs' circumvention of the $100 million cap in violation of the RFP. And three, DPW failed to maintain a complete procurement record required under Guam procurement law. Timeliness, I'll get back to that at the end. Okay, the second ground, about the IDIQ and the $100 million cap, which Cortex seems to think is really a big issue in this case. And like I said in the beginning, it's really a non-issue, and it was confirmed during the course of this hearing. What is my point regarding this? Well, whether the IDIQ violates the terms of the RFP with regard to a so-called $100 million cap is really a non-issue. And again, I'm just going back to my previous argument in my opening statement that, first of all, the proposed IDIQ contract is negotiated but not fully executed. That is, the AG and the governor have to sign itself. And I think Mr. Keeler also made a reference to that it's not a fully executed contract. And there may be changes later on. The AG still has to review it. still a couple of things that DPW needs to do to prepare it for transmission to the AG, but the point being that it's still not fully executed contract, and it's subject to change. So what about this IDIQ contract? Well, it itself incorporates by reference the RFP and makes it part of the contract. The RFP itself and all of its attachments, amendments, and addenda are made part of the IDIQ contract by virtue of Section 5. And therefore, if you look at Cortex ground, what is the ground of its protest here? This is a direct quote. The IDIQ contract envisions thief circumvention of the $100 million cap in violation of the RFP. So what is my argument there? Because the IDIQ incorporates the RFP and all of its amendments, it cannot violate itself. It's a legal impossibility. So the last ground here, Section 3.1 of the IDIQ, therefore cannot be read to interpret it or interpreted to violate the RFP, as Cortex contends, because the RFP is part of the IDIQ. Okay, so that's my first legal point. What's my next point on this, which was revealed during the hearing? It's a non-issue because everybody conceded on the government side and as well as GIF that there's a $100 million cap. Despite all of this clear testimonial evidence, Cortex stomps its feet down and says, no, 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 it can't be true. What you're saying, you're not admitting what I want you to say, that you're circumventing this cap. It was clear. Did anybody hesitate when Mr. Inman was asked? Mr. Inman, what's your understanding of the $100 million cap? Mr. Inman said, it's a $100 million cap. When Mr. Easter was asked, what is your understanding of the $100 million cap, Mr. Easter? Mr. Easter said, it's a $100 million cap. And I believe the same thing goes with all the other government witnesses when they were asked. What is your understanding of the IDIQ and the RFP? A $100 million cap. And yet Cortex continues to invent these issues where there are none. I think this issue is really a non-issue, and it should be a dead one at this point, because there is no dispute that there is a $100 million cap in the RFP. The third ground, about the procurement record. So Mr. Keeler said a lot about this, and for the most part, I will defer to him on this or the government's point of view, but this is what GIF does have to say. Based on Cortex's notice of appeal, there are two issues: that there's purportedly, you know, no log of communications, and this issue about sound recordings. What we would point out is the 5,000-page procurement record, as it currently exists, is replete with drafts, communications, minutes of meetings, evaluations. In other words, there's just a lot of documents there. It is a voluminous procurement record. It contains emails, it contains notes. We went through Mr. Easter with all the negotiating committee meetings and the negotiations that occurred between, what was it, I guess, January and May of this year. And we were able to go through each one of those key points in which the government and Heath undertook negotiations. Okay, and with regard to this communications log that DPW has stated, that the communications log can and will be completed prior to certification of the record and award of the IDIQ. And of course, as was pointed out during the course of the hearings, is that Cortex protests, of course, have stayed the procurement thus far, and so everything is pretty much at a standstill. And as soon as the process is allowed to proceed, that's when the procurement record will be completed and certified and transmitted to the AG. What I would point out with regard to the log, this supposed log of communications, now, if you go back to the statute, which is 5 GCA 5429, I would have call attention to the fact that this statute doesn't require a log of all communications whatsoever in the entire universe. You know, every sticky that's written to anybody or any conversation that's mentioned in passing in the hallway, you know, it doesn't require that. It only requires that the communications between government employees and any member of the public, potential bidder, now you notice also that they're using the word bidder, not proposer here, okay? And then vendor, manufacturer, which is in any way related to the procurement. So this requirement does not require a log of communications between, for example, the government employees and other government employees and officials. Doesn't require, you know, government to government employee communications. Doesn't require communications between government employees and potential proposers for an RFP. It doesn't say proposers, it says potential bidders. It doesn't require a log of communications between the government and actual proposers. It uses the word bidder here. It doesn't even say actual bidder, it says potential bidders. And it certainly doesn't require a log of all communications between the government and the most qualified proposer. So, meaning then that in this particular case, communications between the government and HEIF. And so in any event, if one looks at the terms of the RFP, the RFP provides that questions from the public must be in writing and all communications addressed to the designated single point of contact. That's why you have a single point of contact, to make sure that there is a controlled valve of how these communications are channeled. It requires that, like I said, all questions have to be in writing, all communications have to be in writing to the single point of contact. And I believe, in fact, if you go to the RFP, it says that any violation of that single point of contact rule, which I believe we got into some testimony during the hearing, it says that if any potential proposer violates that single point of contact rule, that they may be disqualified. All right, so in summary, as Mr. Keeler pointed out, this is the testimony of Mr. Kalanayan, that he could recommend certification of the record, and he's able to recreate the log, whatever log is required by law. Sound recordings. I won't get into this too much, except that as a matter of law, we made our presentation in the beginning, and this is based on the language of the statute, upon the semicolon versus the comma. And I think we would just emphasize that's Keith's position, that sound recordings are not mandatory under the statute. It only applies to pre-bid conferences, not even pre-proposal conferences. And I believe that the testimony that was submitted during the course of the hearing is that the practice of the agencies, at least with regard to DPW, that they had not done any sound recordings of negotiation meetings, and that practice may have changed in late spring of 2016, and that was based on his discussions with another assistant AG with regard to another procurement. I would note also, if you look at Mr. Romero's testimony on September 15, 2016, that GDOE's practice was to not do sound recordings. That's what he testified. These are just arguments in the beginning regarding the sound recordings, the interpretation of the law, legislative history. In general, we believe that the semicolon that was inserted by the compiler of laws was a clerical correction that was allowed under the compiler of laws statute. Actually, it's called a typographical correction, as referenced in the law, 1 GCA. And this is our argument as to why only pre-bid conferences apply. It's because pre-bid conferences are a very specific term of art that's used, and it applies in invitation for bids and not in RFPs. Okay, documentation of the procurement record. And this is just something worth noting, that if you do look at the procurement record I mentioned, both the government and he mentioned it's over 5,000 pages, but if you look at it, and I looked at the index to see exactly how it was organized, but it contains these items: logs of distribution, minutes and summaries of pre-submission conferences, logs of attendees of pre-submission conferences, written questions. This tab 17, any and all communications from or to anyone concerning any part of ITB or RFP, when I went to that tab, actually, that was over 400 pages thick. And this was just from the procurement record that was filed on July 1st, 2016. I believe that there were probably more than five supplements that were filed after that. And of course, when we went through the testimony of Mr. Easter earlier this week on Tuesday, we submitted portions of the record, which documented the negotiations between Keith and the government, and we went over that extensively. So, in general, it's Keith's position that, and I said, and like Mr. Easter testified, that his process, at least, his experience during the negotiation phase, Mr. Inman also testified that there was enough documentation in the record, at least documentation, to know exactly at what key points in the procurement process things took place and why they took place. And as I would refer also, when I went back to this previous legislative history concerning these sound recordings, I did make a note that the legislative history of the bill that was introduced, the intent here was to document process of the procurement. The process of procurement shall be documented at each step of the process. And I think if you also look at the specific requirements of the law now, 3114M, that was the section that required the negotiation memorandum. That was just a written memorandum that was required to be in the file. Okay. On the issue of timeliness, again, I believe it's incumbent on us to raise this because I believe it's jurisdictional. And we do believe that the second notice of appeal was untimely, the third protest. And why? Well, it's because CORTEC claims that its grounds for the notice of appeal, the protest that was filed on July 15th, was based on documents it received on July 1st. And that was in response to a FOIA that was made on June 14th. Well, when I questioned Mr. Ho on this June 14th FOIA was based on the May 13th notice of intent to award, which was done about a month previously. And we also saw on the record that CORTEC had also filed previous Sunshine Act requests, more specifically in conjunction with the December 22nd notice that Geith was selected as the most qualified offerer, which Mr. Ho acknowledged in the record was received on December 24th. So from December 24th, 2015 until their FOIA record was written on January 4th, I believe, 2016. That was 11 days later, very fast. So our point in this timeliness issue is that CORTEC could have seen these documents earlier. In other words, according to the law, it knew or should have known of the basis for its protest much earlier than July 1st of 2016. And this is, and I'll leave it for digestion in detail more, but this summarizes that my points about the Sunshine Act, what it requires, that everybody is allowed to inspect a copy of the public record, and based on CORTEC's earlier letters, Sunshine Act letters, proving that they acted quickly, they certainly acted quickly back in December and January within 11 days. Still, after May 13, 2016, they delayed, and they waited over a month until they submitted their FOIA. So we believe, based on those grounds, that CORTEC should have known, and under the statute, then this protest was untimely. Okay, so CORTEC's, the last point that I would make is CORTEC belatedly raised and improperly raised issues in its filings in this appeal are beyond the OPA's jurisdiction. And in my opening statements, I mentioned that in the beginning, when CORTEC filed its list of issues, it listed 11. It whittled them down to 6, finally, in their hearing brief, which was filed on September 2nd, and only five of which really were germane to the issues on appeal. Okay? And the basis for the obligation to disregard those issues that are not properly before the OPA are contained in the OPA's rules, 2 Gar. Division 12104. And it says that the written appeal shall be in substantially the same form as Exhibit A and include at a minimum the following: a concise, logically arranged, and direct statement of the grounds for appeal. So they had to have listed the grounds for their appeal. Again, I raised this in the sixth issue, which had to do with Mr. Calvo. Actually, Portec raised this in a different context in their hearing brief. They later brought Mr. Calvo as a witness, but they said, oh, we're only calling him as a witness now because it has to do with the procurement record. So basically what they did is that they abandoned the initial issue that they identified in their hearing brief, and therefore the issue is abandoned and is not within the OPA's jurisdiction to consider. And I also mentioned this in the context of the other issues that are mentioned in Cortex's filings and were brought up during the hearing, but were not mentioned in its notices of appeal, and it's Steve's position that those issues are beyond the scope of the OPA's jurisdiction to decide. So as an example, I will just touch upon this because I think that there was a lot of effort that was made by Cortex to discuss this about the initial Simon Sanchez High School cost estimate. And what Geef would point out is that it was shown during the hearing that it was impermissible for the government to evaluate costs. In fact, in one of the RFIs, it was said that the government will not evaluate the cost estimate for Simon Sanchez High School. This is in the initial proposals that were submitted in November, even if it is still required to be submitted. And the second point is that cost is not part of the evaluation factors of the RFP. That's in Cortec Exhibit 2, page 48. And as I pointed out during the testimony of one of the witnesses, it was testified to that if the cost estimate had been evaluated by the committee, selection committee, that this would have violated the terms of the RFP. Why? Because cost was not an evaluation factor. And again, there was some talk here about what was included or what was not included, or how definitive was these cost estimates that were submitted. Well, Geef would point out that, one, there was no finding made by the government that any proposer was non-responsive. And if any proposer is aggrieved by that, we believe that it must first protest to DPW and get a decision on that protest. And the remedy is to file a new appeal to the OPA. But as Mr. Keeler pointed out also extensively, and I'll defer to him on that point, I think we would agree with the government's issue and treatment on that, that the issue of non-responsiveness was just something that within the RFP was treated. None of the members of the negotiating committee found that any proposer was non-responsive, and the finding of non-responsiveness was not something that was mandatory in any event. Okay, in conclusion, Geef believes that the OPA should deny both of these appeals and... Okay, I just have one more thing to show. Some parting thoughts from Geef.
Mr. A, before you proceed,
yes,
was this part of the evidentiary record?
It's statements, arguments from principals of youth.
But were these from the record?
It's not evidence that was on the record, but it's argument.
We would object to that. I think it should be limited.
You can't put, okay, these are closing arguments made by the party's attorneys. Okay.
Okay, so are you making, so this is not something that is going to be allowed then?
I'm not going to allow your witnesses to testify again on closing.
Okay, it's not testimony, but if the hearing officer doesn't want to allow it, it's okay.
No, I'm not going to permit it.
Okay.
Okay. That'll be
so Geef concludes its closing arguments.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tang, you have 16 minutes for your rebuttal.
I'll try not to use all of it. Should we turn that off? Just because there's a lot of background noise, please. Thank you. A lot of discussion about Exhibit A. Are these considerations general documents? Are they wish lists, programs? Are they a laundry list? What are they? They're minimum requirements. We can call it whatever we want to call it. That's what they are. And that's what conceptual plans were derived from, and that's what the cost proposals from Pernix, Cortec, and even Geef came from. Where else could they have come from? If there wasn't biddable, if you couldn't put a cost to it, someone would have said into RFI. There was no question on that point. Geef conceded that. Mr. Eamon said that as well. Mr. Easter, said that as well. Let's talk about our teachers. Yes, they're not facility developers, but much like families who, or people who, users, end users who want to develop buildings or houses, you know what you want. You know, you want to walk in, if I were developing a house, I know how big of a house I might want, how many kitchens, if I want a kitchen, an outside kitchen, if I would like a walk-in closet, if I would like a large walk-in bathroom. All of these things are people, are end user decisions. And that's what these teachers are. The teachers are not stupid. They're not dumb. They know what they and the students need. And that's exactly what they put in Exhibit A. Now, we heard a testimony from, I believe Mr. Inman saying that, well, you know, our facility developers, we deleted the computer rooms. What did these facility designers know? And not to pick on any particular districts, kids from Swamp Road, Dededo, Jigo, may not have access to computers, that they would actually need a computer lab to do their homework. They just deleted it. This is what teachers know. The teachers know what the students have. Not every child walk around with a device or a computer, a laptop. Most homeworks require some kind of, you know, access to a computer. And they don't, a lot of kids simply don't have that. So these teachers know. They're not stupid, and they should not be dismissed and disregarded so easily by the government and by Geef. Now, Mr. McKeough testified that he was surprised that Exhibit A was drafted without the consulting a facility planner. But he also said it was fine. It was not intended to be a military DB RFP. We'd heard a lot about that. That's not what it was. But the proof is in the pudding. Every single proposer submitted a price. Every single proposer submitted a conceptual plan. Let's talk about jurisdictional issues. I think we'll dispense with the FOIA argument. We could have filed more FOIA and faster, and yes, we could have done a lot of things, but that is not what triggers the time to file. It's when you're aggrieved, all right, and you're aggrieved bitter. That's the standard. It's not when I should have, I had a free week this week, I should have gotten my FOIA out. This is the most ludicrous argument I've ever heard. If that were the case, none of us would have any timely proposals or timely appeals, excuse me, protests. With respect to the May 27 protest, that was filed within 14 days after May 13, the date that we received information regarding the negotiation award. Okay, the intent to award with the attached memoranda. We couldn't have gotten it out earlier. Where is the timeliness issue on that? The bond, very simple.
CoreTech has a billion-dollar bonding capacity. It bids on many design-build projects. And bonding companies, depending on, like Hansel Phelps, your reputation, you go and bid on design-build projects. As long as you have a concept, you've got indemnity to back up the surety. The surety will issue the bond. That argument is false and without merit. Randy Romero, never met him before he came to court today, or came to the hearing today, this month. I found him credible. I found him very interested and caring. He really cared. His documents, his communications show that this man cared about the process. He testified he has $40 billion procurement experience. He had more procurement experience than the entire negotiating team put together. So let's not be so dismissive about Mr. Randy Romero. He's just a staffer. Mr. Fernandez relied on him. Mr. Fernandez took his two memos, the March 11, March and April 16 memo, and circulated it. Nobody said a peep about it. Where was DPW? Where were the lawyers? Mr. Easter testified, well, AGs are in a room, so I don't even have to deal with it. If it's legal, illegal, it's not my problem. They're there. Let's talk about the record. There are no phone calls or in the communication log. And these records cannot be recreated. We all know that. You don't have to get an expert. It's common sense. There are communication. There must have been communications regarding those two memos written by Mr. Romero, March 11 and April 19. We have seen none. You mean to tell me there were no phone calls? There were no emails? There were no meetings? These are just standalone, and everybody just said, well, let's just move on. There is no record. How about the communication with Geese? Yes, we have agendas and on all the other stuff, but we also have meetings with Gita that we didn't even know about until Mana Silva got on the stand and said, hey, you know, Champ was here, Ms. Damien's here, here's what we talked about. Where's that record? The $100 million cap, IDIQ, that was an issue this morning. Mr. Easter couldn't tell you, he's one of the Geef guys. He can't tell you how that overriding mechanism ended up in the agreement. Well, I don't recall. Well, that's important because who put in there, who agreed to it? He pointed fingers at the two lawyers in this room. But has anybody come forward and explained how that overriding mechanism ended up in the IDIQ? No one has explained that. Tell me, how can you have a complete procurement record? I think at the end of the day, there has to be a level playing field. There has to be transparency. You have to do it right. This procurement was not done right. Thank you.
Well, I think the OPA is definitely in agreement with the parties. When you say that this was the historically the longest appeals hearing we've had for a procurement appeal, that is very true. And I want to, before we end, thank all the parties and also the institutional reps that were here almost daily for this very long proceeding. And I want to thank you all for the professionalism and the kindness that you've shown to each other. Likewise, you've shown to the OPA. We're going to take this this appeal under advisement, both of them. We will be issuing our decision. Just a reminder, the parties have until Friday, October the 14th, to file their remedies brief. The government and the interested party will also have until 5 p.m. on Friday to essentially file their oppositions, if any, to the appellant's request to consider responsiveness. And then the appellant will have until 5 p.m. on Friday, October the 21st, to file their reply to any oppositions filed to its request to consider responsiveness. Are there any other issues we need to take up at this time?
No, thank you.
Okay, these proceedings have concluded. We'll offer record.
Thank you.
May I just give everybody a copy of that email that you asked for?
Sure.
We're off the record at 4:42 p.m.